Hello and welcome to the Mijlis Podcast, Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's current affairs talk show focusing on Central Asia. I'm Bruce Pannier, host of the Mijlis and author of the Central Asia in Focus newsletter. In late June, Tajikistan passed a law that banned, quote, alien clothing, unquote. The Central Asian governments have been monitoring their citizens' appearance for years. Young men with beards, for example, have been targets of authorities in several Central Asian countries for years now. When officials see a young man with a beard, they seem to think Islamic extremist, so beards are banned. But there is no doubt that the fashion police in Central Asia have a gender bias when judging what constitutes acceptable or traditional clothing. To discuss all this, I am joined by Svetlana Dzardanova, human rights researcher of Freedom for Eurasia, who is based in Kyrgyzstan, and Nigina Han Saida, a researcher, educator, and freelance journalist from Uzbekistan. Nigina studies Islam, education, and gender issues in Central Asia with a focus on Uzbekistan. So thank you both for joining me. Nigina, I want to start with you. You and Sher Kasimov just wrote an article published by The Beat about the law passed in Tajikistan on alien clothing. Could you tell us about that, please?
Yes, Sher Kasimov and I explored how Tajikistan recently passed the law banning the quote-unquote import, sale, promotion, and use of clothing alien to the national culture. And while the ban applies to modern clothes, like too revealing, too short, and other types of clothes, primarily it seems to be aimed at curtailing the use of Muslim clothing in Tajikistan. This is not the first time that Tajikistan has been trying to control women's clothing, especially in the matters of hijab. We can see it through the different bans that has been in place in Tajikistan for a while. The first time Tajikistan's president Rahmon's obsession against hijab was noted in 2015, if I'm not mistaken, when he expressed his concerns, for example, and called Tajik activists to promote national outfits among the public. But even earlier, in 2007, the Ministry of Education of Tajikistan published its instruction banning hijab and miniskirts for schools and university students. So it has been going on for a while, and it's not particular to Tajikistan only. We can see the similar pattern of efforts from the government side to control women's outfit, especially attacking on hijab in other Central Asian countries as well.
Thank you, Nigina. Svetlana, you're also quoted in this article that Nigina and Sher wrote. Can you tell me a little bit about who's deciding what's traditional clothing and you know what that should be exactly? I mean, I should add in the Tajik case, they don't like black. Nigina might have mentioned that, but they don't like black clothing either. I mean, who's responsible for deciding what's acceptable clothing and what's not?
Yes, thank you, Bruce. I think maybe it's the key question here in our discussion on who decides what's traditional clothing and what's not, and who decides on imposing the rules. So I think state definitely has more resources on imposing what its nationals should or should not wear. And depending on what the government and the state fears, we see how locals are controlled. And this is the controversy, because it's both targets the modern revealing, so to say, clothing, but it also attacks too modest clothing. So, and it really depends on what we mean by traditional clothing, like states in Central Asia promoting traditional clothing, coming back to the roots and stuff like that. But what really is traditional clothing? So across Central Asia, there is a trend on revival of traditional clothing. And if we look at what designers are offering in countries like Kazakhstan or Kyrgyzstan, which I follow more closely, of course, there is strong trend towards blending old and new fashion elements. Like we see there are many new trademarks popping up, like offering interesting fashion designs. And this revival might be a bit different in Turkmenistan, Uzbekistan, and Tajikistan, because the traditional national clothing is more commonly worn in these three countries. So this trend isn't as pronounced in the three I mentioned. So we see how many young brands see a very new emerging niche of traditional styles, blending them with contemporary fashion trends. So, and it also comes along with growing emphasis on local cultures and languages, specifically after the conflicts in the region. So people try to look at what constitutes their identity and culture. People are really proud of their identities. And don't mistake me, I mean, it's really wonderful to see. However, this is just one side of the story, because public discourse also highlights a conflict between traditional and so-called alien clothing, so particularly in the context of religious attire. So there are two conflicting tendencies, as I see, and one is grassroots, when people want to see more national traditional clothing in the streets, and the other one is state-imposed, out of fear of extremism and religious leaders being at rise.
Okay, thank you. You know, I'm going to get back to Islamic clothing in just a second, but I want to get one thing. I want to talk about one thing that's been on my mind for a while here that has to do with Western clothing. Now, you've described, and this is a question for both of you, you described that, you know, that it seems that this is targeting women, things like the hijab and the clothing they have, that has to be traditional. You were just saying traditional, Svetlana. Okay. When I was in Central Asia in the 1990s, men did not wear shorts. I wore shorts in 1990 to walk around Bukhara, and all these old men started screaming at me for wearing shorts, right? But now that's okay. So how does traditional clothing work for men then? Nagina?
I'm not sure I'm ready for that question, because men's clothing are not much different, right? Men are welcome to wear whatever they feel like, but they are not restricted in any way. But that doesn't mean, like, culturally they are eager to try everything, right? They are more still, like, we're talking about Muslim majority countries, so men prefer to wear long shorts. Of course, there are, like, short shorts as well out there, but most men still resort to long trousers, t-shirts. It's not controversial a lot.
Okay, thank you. Svetlana, same thing. You know, they're against, the authorities are against revealing clothing. Shorts are certainly not anything that was traditional in Central Asia that I ever read about. How do they reconcile the fact that women aren't supposed to wear short skirts, but men can wear shorts?
Yeah, I really agree with Nagina here. It's like men's attire, like, is less controversial. It's true in like big cities like Bishkek, Almaty, men wear shorts. And but if we look at the trends and come back to the religious attire, then there are a vivid trend in social networks like Instagram, when people explain that men also should wear modest clothing. But it doesn't seem to be a huge problem for the state. But when it comes to the appearance revealing some of the religious attitudes and beliefs, like big bushy beards, then the attitude of the state is different. But it's true that these policies, they affect women disproportionately, because when we look at the, I don't know if you travel the region and you've been here like 5 years ago, and then you see that in the streets, there are more and more women with headscarves. And I think this is more visible to to other people, to state officials, when they understand that the religious population is growing. I remember in 2016, Kyrgyz President Atambayev at that time, he sponsored a campaign against Arabization of clothing, because he saw that women more and more start wearing very modest, closed religious clothing, and he was against the trend.
Okay, thank you. Nagina, let's go back to, let's get, continue with the Islamic clothing. You know, I'm curious what, again, who, when they're looking at what's acceptable Islamic clothing in this, on the streets, in business places, is it truly representative of traditional values in a place called, like, Uzbekistan, for instance, or Tajikistan? I mean, you see old photos from the 19th century from the area, and women are actually completely veiled, completely covered in some areas, right? So you know, and a lot of the clothing is dark. So what is exactly is the basis for determining what is acceptable Islamic clothing and what is not? If you can tell, help me out with that.
Okay, maybe we can circle back to the initial question and dig a little bit with the legal documents, if you do not mind.
Yeah, please.
Aha. So in Uzbekistan, there was a law, for example, against wearing praying clothes, ibadat libasa, right, in public places. But that law was abolished, not law, that was an article in the administrative code of the Republic of Uzbekistan, and that was abolished last year, right? But there are still certain articles in the administrative and the criminal code of Uzbekistan, for example, that does not exactly specify, but still gives you some clue, right? I'm going to go through a couple of them, if you do not mind. For example, Article 184.4 of the Administrative Code of Uzbekistan on wearing a non-identifying appearances in public, right? Which basically means that you are not allowed to cover your face in public with a veil, niqab, or anything, to the extent that it does not allow identification of the person. Right. For example, law enforcement officers or others should be able to see that who you are. Right. And the in other cases, like a person is punished with a fine. There are exclusions for that, of course. For example, if you are wearing a helmet, right, or medical masks or similar gears that are used for professional uses or for other purposes. Right. Recently, for example, in July, a 22-year-old boy, for example, arrested at near Chorsu market in Tashkent because he was wearing a full hijab and niqab. So the reason for his arrest was explained. One of the reasons for his arrest was that he was in public in a clothing that did not allow his identity to be known. That's one thing. There is also Article 184.2, which is on illegal production, storage, import, or distribution of religious materials. And it's also punishable with fine from $500 approximately to $2,500. I couldn't find many cases related to it in regard to clothing. But last year, 23-year-old boy from Namangan was charged with that article because he married, basically, and his wedding videos of which circulated across social media shows the bride was full in white clothes and the white niqab. Only her eyes were visible, and he himself was wearing red kufaya and white Arabic traditional clothing, right? And later on, he admitted that he gave the religious tone, quote unquote, to the wedding on his own initiative and out of personal conviction, etc. And he was charged with that article. There are also, what is interesting is that the pattern in Central Asian countries with the law to influence or impact on women's clothing goes through educational institutions, right? For example, in Uzbekistan, there is a law from 2018, passed on August 15, on measures to provide students of state general secondary education institutions with a modern school uniform, right? And Sections 3, Article 6 and 7 are particularly interesting. For example, Paragraph 6 here talks about clothes, that it shouldn't be too tight. It shouldn't be too wide for girls. Like the length of the skirt should be 5 to 15 centimeters below the knee. For boys, the length of the pants should be below the ankles, etc. So the specifics of the clothing is right at schools. And paragraph 7 says school children must walk inside the building of the educational institution without headgear, like without headscarf, anything on their heads. And explanation to the law, to this paragraph, is given right here. I'm quoting here, if I may, right? Due to the fact that the population of Uzbekistan consists of representatives of different nationalities and religious denominations, and due to the fact that compulsory general secondary education has a secular character, school uniforms of students should not include elements that reflect belonging to different religions and denominations, as well as different subcultures, right? And they are giving examples of hijab, kippah, kafiya, cross, and etc. And the same pattern we can observe in other countries, such as, for example, Kazakhstan. Last year, in October, banned hijab for students and teachers to preserve secularism. Right. And, the president, Tokayev was insisting that one's religion is their private affair. And prior to that law, Astana's efforts to ban the hijab were enforced through the Ministry of Education's decree on uniform at schools that did not allow, quote unquote, wearing religious symbols at school. The Tajikistan, I guess I mentioned earlier, it's the same, right? The, in 2017, as early as 2017, Ministry of Education of Tajikistan published an instruction banning niqab and miniskirts for school and university students. So what we see here is that the reason the, Central Asian states are giving is preserving secularism at school, saying that, schools are not for wearing religious items or showing religious belonging to one faith or another. And going back to your question, like, why suddenly have those dark-colored hijabs have become trendy? I'm going to agree with Svetlana when she mentioned that there is a genuine resurgence of Islamic beliefs, like people are going back. Yes, the style is a little bit different than what we used it to have, for example, before the Soviet invasion. But women are still covering themselves, right? And the niqab is particularly issue because government is explaining it, saying that it's making it impossible to identify the person behind the niqab. And we this summer, we have seen a couple of cases already in Uzbekistan where men have been caught wearing niqab. And am I speaking too much? I wanted to talk a little bit about the emergence of hijab as well.
Please, please go ahead.
So going back to why exactly those different styles of hijab, right? For example, if you look at Turkey, women in Turkey wear different style, right? And Turks are ethnically and linguistically closer to Central Asian nations than Arabs, but still those Arabic style, especially the black outfits or other monocolored hijabs have become trendy. And I think there is a role of social media as well. Because you see, rich Arab social media influencers flaunt their wealthy lifestyle on social media while wearing those abayas, burqas, hijabs, and etc., right? And they are showing their luxury cars, jewelry, designer clothes, etc. on their social media pages. While there is a majority of women who actually who wear hijab out of their face. But when it comes to style choice, there could be an influence of that as well, right? We see so many social media influencers, rich social media influencers, wearing black abaya, like which is more traditional to Arabic nations. So we imitate. So that's why we see often politicians speaking about Arabization, like explaining themselves, we are not against Islam. You are welcome if you would like to wear rumal, for example, right? A headscarf, traditional headscarf, but we are against Arabization. The same we see at schools. Recently, I read about the school in Namangan, for example, organizing a class hour for girl students because 5 or 10 of them were wearing hijab. They explained that at school you can wear rumal, but hijab preferably not too. So that's what I wanted to say. And if I also want, if you do not mind me adding a little bit more, apart from Islamization, like the Central Asian nations genuinely trying to follow Islam more because now there is independence and the Soviet atheism is in the past, there is also trend of using women as a trophy, probably, right? Because I'm going to explain. Many women also start wearing hijab to please the men in their family, especially the man they want to marry or the man they have already married to, or their husbands make them through manipulation or through, you know, saying like you are either going to wear hijab or we are going to divorce, etc. Right. So while the public adherence to Islam is one explanation why more and more men want their women in their family to cover up, but there is also another aspect, right? The hijabi women because there are in some countries certain bans, like, for example, hijabi women cannot work at public institutions or at universities or at schools, etc., or at banks, etc. So women often become a housewife, right? It signals two things. It signals the husband's status, like saying that, hey, here, I can earn enough to support both myself and my wife, so she stays at home. She's a trophy wife. She's a housewife. And also it shows obedience towards the husband. So it has become a bragging point for men as well. I'm not saying it's everywhere, but there is this element as well.
Okay. Oh, great. Thank you. Thank you. And a reminder, we're talking about recent rules and laws on clothing in Central Asia. And my guests are Nigina Hansaida, a researcher, educator, and freelance journalist from Uzbekistan. She studies Islam, education, and gender issues in Central Asia with a focus on Uzbekistan, and Svetlana Dardanova, human rights researcher at Freedom for Eurasia, who is based in Kyrgyzstan. Svetlana, I want to start with you. You've raised some interest. We've had a lot of interesting points in this, but education seems to be one of the forefronts of this battle, if you will, on clothing. I mean, there's a lot of this starts a headscarf and what clothes you can wear seems to start in schools. So I want to talk a little bit about that. But first, would you explain to me hujum and what that means? Because we're going to get to that in a second too.
So the hujum campaign is the campaign at Soviet times, like at the emergence of Soviet times in Central Asia. So the campaign was aimed at liberating and emancipating women in Central Asia. And it was often manifested through removal. And sometimes it was encouraged, but sometimes it was forced removal or even burning of traditional Muslim head covers and veils in Central Asia. So we know that the Central Asian population was predominantly Muslim. And the reforms that Soviets brought in to Central Asia, it was manifested through freeing, so to say, women from this religious burden, like across all other Soviet republics. So the Hujum campaign was aimed at bringing education, secularism to local population. And it was a part of it was manifested and showed through women getting rid of Muslim head covers. So it's really close tendencies if we look at education. So the education in Soviet, so to say, understanding was also coming along with secularism. It's interesting how back then and now we understand secularism, because when we look at the Central Asian republics at now and also across Europe, secular means you don't manifest your religion. It doesn't mean that the state doesn't intervene in your religious affairs, right? Like, for instance, France banning religious head covers to its own team members, like Olympic team members, which is, I think, both racial and gender discrimination. And it seems the same in Central Asia, like banning hijabs for education institutions also seems very gendered. And also, I mean, it targets only one of the religions, right? I mean, it first of all targets women and young girls who want to get their education, but also it specifically targets Muslim population in Central Asian republics. Like, women and girls often, like religious women and girls, they find themselves caught between the state regulations and their own community expectations. I mean, their families and their religious communities wants them to cover, and they are expected to be modest. But the state regulations puts them between the very difficult choice. I mean, it's usually even not their choice to make. I mean, it's their families, their mothers and fathers who are making this choice. So these young girls from very religious families, they risk losing their social networks, like in school, universities, and this results like in very limited opportunities. For instance, if their families adhere to strict dress codes, they might resort for homeschooling or like withdrawing their girls from formal education entirely. So it means in the future, they have fewer opportunities.
Thank you for bringing up that point. Nagin, I want to ask you about that too. With the restrictions on what you can wear in school, do you think that is leading to a trend where fewer young women are likely to pursue education past the mandatory education years?
Thank you for the question, Bruce. If you're asking about particularly about Uzbekistan, I do not think so, given that parents, for example, who do not allow for any reason for their children not to attend compulsory secondary general education, they face administrative charges. There is a fine, of course, and then I think even if that doesn't work, there could be criminal charges. Again, I'm not sure, but there is a responsibility. So, and if you also look at the statistics of the graduation rate, the almost everyone graduates. There are very few school dropouts. And regarding covering their heads, there are some issues. It's still a controversial topic in like whether girls should be allowed to wear a headscarf at schools or not. But I don't think there is a problem with rumal, at least of that what I'm reading from. From local media, drop secondary education completely because that's not allowed by law. However, there is a trend of if you come from a wealthy family, you can send your kids to private school, and I don't think private schools have this strict regulation against hijab either. And regarding the universities, there are plenty of opportunities, especially for girls. Like Uzbekistan has been trying to improve this gender imbalance that we used to have in higher education, boys versus girls. So there are many grammar. So there are many private universities and the campuses and branches of international universities in Uzbekistan as well, as an option, I mean. So I don't think hijab would prevent too many women from education in Uzbekistan, like it used to, for example, during the previous government. I personally know some girls, for example, who decided not to go to university because they were wearing a hijab. And they decided instead of fighting or facing those troubles, they decided altogether not to pursue higher education.
Okay, thank you. Svetlana, before we leave this topic, in Nagina's article, you mentioned that in Kazakhstan, a lot of young women are opting, and even schoolgirls, I suppose, are opting to study online because of this. Is that true?
Yes, I talked to some of the Kazakh experts, and they say that they either drop out or they move to neighboring countries for continuing their education, for instance, to Kyrgyzstan, where there is still a more relaxed regime, or they opt for online education via online Russian schools. Also, I think that in many cases, the regulations affect more of adult population, like adult women who work at education institutions or government agencies, for instance. I know of a case, like Nagina mentioned, that there are options for hijabi women when they want to study, and they can opt for private schools. But I know of a case in Kyrgyzstan when a private school fired a teacher because of hijab, and because they said that this was against their secular values, which is, again, I want to repeat, is strange that secular now means you intervene in what women want to wear or opt to wear. So yes, online education is an option, but it's not an option for everyone. I mean, it's a privilege as well. I mean, getting an education where online school can be expensive. Not all families can do that for their children. So also moving to another country for your children's education also can be a very tricky option.
And okay. Also accreditation also issue, because we do not know if those Russian online schools credentials are recognized in Kazakhstan or Kyrgyzstan, for example, or if you go outside to foreign countries and study and obtain a higher education diploma from any university. There is accreditation issue, which is a little bit difficult in Central Asian countries, unless it's like very high profile university. So there are too many troubles with that, what I want to say.
Okay, thank you. You know, I also want to run through what, you know, there's also a right to freedom of religion, at least it's in all the constitutions in Central Asia, right? So, and it was even in your article that, you know, they, one of the people said, look, this is my religious obligation, and so I'm going to do it. What are the penalties? And we'll just, I'll let you talk about Uzbekistan and Tajikistan, and Svetlana talk about Kazakhstan and Kyrgyzstan. What are the penalties if I wear these clothes anyway? If I, you know, for young women, if they just insist upon wearing religious clothing, what happens to them?
With Tajikistan's case, the recent ban that was passed on late June, right, and the which banned the import, sale, promotion, and use of clothing aligned to the national culture, right, and there is administrative punishment, as far as I understood it, and the fine. Varies, right? If it's ordinary person, it's about $740 for each violation. But if you are civil servant or religious figure with high profile, the fine might reach as high as over $5,000, which is a huge amount of money for ordinary citizen in Tajikistan. In Uzbekistan, for example, I talked about different laws from the administrative code, right? And most of them, again, consider fines. For example, if you cover yourself so much that it's impossible to recognize you, to identify you, right? That the amount of fine is 10 to 15 times of the base calculation amount, which is around from $300 onwards. So, so far, those laws envision fines only.
Okay, thank you. Svetlana, what about Kyrgyzstan and Kazakhstan? What if it, you know, we're leaving Turkmenistan out of this conversation because it's kind of a unique situation, but Kyrgyzstan and Kazakhstan, what about pious women who wish to wear religious clothing because they feel it's their obligation? What problems could they face?
There are still no fines in Kyrgyzstan and Kazakhstan because these are new bills that Kazakhstan and Kyrgyzstan are just considering. So in case of Kyrgyzstan, the idea is not to impose the ban on hijab, but niqab, as Nigina said, the clothing that entirely covers the face, so it makes the identification process difficult. So when a person only sees the eyes of a covered woman. And in Kazakhstan, they also consider introducing the ban for niqabs in public places, but there is still no numbers yet on how much the fine would be for breaking the rules in public.
Okay, thank you. We're getting running out of time here, but I want to give you each both a chance to make some last comments. There's undoubtedly something I didn't cover. How do you see the future of this going forward? But feel free to comment on anything that you think I left out. Nigina, I'll start with you.
Regarding Uzbekistan, I don't see many problems here because I see, again, many women conveniently wearing hijabs in public places, working, etc. At education institutions, it's a little bit controversial, remains controversial. But again, President Mirziyoyev, in 2021, I believe, like a couple of years ago, promised that there wouldn't be a problem if anyone is wearing headscarf, rumal, right, traditional clothing. In other cases, especially if you look at the recent ban on Tajikistan, if it's really enforced and the women are not allowed to wear hijabs or hijabi women are not allowed to education institutions or other public institutions to work, to study, that's going to make women housebound. Right, where they would be completely dependent on men, they lose their networks. They will not be able to, you know, stay in touch with their friends or go out and see friends, etc. And they might again, radicalize them even more because they would be stuck with their online life. Or another option is moving out of the country. And the brain drain is already a huge issue in the region, right? The bright young people are moving out, basically. So I see those difficulties. Like it leaves women, again, with the choice of either choosing their own religion or choosing education and career.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Svetlana, last word. Anything you want to say that I missed?
Yes. So I think that the reasoning behind these policies is often framed around security concerns or the need to protect cultural traditions. And I see the discourse, the public discourse going around the securitization. And we have seen a wave of bans, like hijab bans or temporary hijab bans in across Central Asia and Russia after the Krakow City Hall terrorist attack. But my concern is that women were never part of the attack. So I don't really understand the ban on hijabs in this specific case. And I think also that the regulation seem at least not logical and also counterproductive. And I see it more as attack on women's rights and on attack on their agency. Because as a woman, I want to make my own choices over my clothing, and I am sure many women do as well. So I think that the measures do more harm than good. And my concern is that they alienate and marginalize women from society. As Nigina mentioned, this affects their education and work opportunities in the future. So my concern is that we should move and like shift the public discourse more on women's rights and their agency in this particular case. Thank you.
Great. Thank you. And I promise we're going to get back to this topic on a future Mejlis podcast. But for now, we're out of time. So thank you, Svetlana and Nigina. And a big thanks, as always, to Nathan Shoemaker, our Mejlis podcast producer in Washington, D.C. And a reminder, you can subscribe to the Mejlis podcast or the Central Asian Focus newsletter by visiting Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's website at rfarl.org. Thanks. And we'll be back in a couple of weeks.